It's 12 teams, twice a year. Go really, really deep with those 12 teams. See them make a lot of progress. Build like lasting relationships that endure well past the accelerator, and like, really get involved with these teams. And it's fun. And it's also like a great seat from a different perspective. Instead of like using the, crypto ecosystem for like a signal, we really get to like partner closely with like thought leaders to support teams and like build out thought leadership.
Welcome to the ATX DAO podcast, the hub for exploring the forefront of blockchain technology and Austin's Web3 community. Your hosts, Nick, Mason, Luke, and Ash, connect you with innovators within ATX DAO and beyond as we venture into the world of decentralized technology. So crack open a beer and join us for a front row seat to learn about the innovations and trends shaping our digital future. This is the ATX DAO podcast.
So Steve, welcome to the show. Thanks for hanging out with us for a little bit today. It's exciting to have a chat. Just to kind of introduce you, and then I'd love to hear a little bit about your background and everything that you have going on. So today we have Steve. He is a partner at the Blockchain Builders Fund and also an alumni chair at the Stanford Blockchain Accelerator. So welcome to the show. Why don't we just dive right in and walk us through your background a little bit? You know, we do our diligence on our hosts or on our guests and spent some time looking through your background, and impressive for sure. Would love to hear a little bit more about your journey into crypto, everything that you've been working on. I've got some specific questions about maybe some stops along the way, but yeah, get us started.
Yeah, talking about myself, that's easy. So yeah, hi, I'm Stephen Willinger. I'll give you the version from the beginning. I graduated from a school called Claremont McKenna, not a technical school, but I was like a technical hobbyist. So I was a software developer straight out of school. I kind of hated it. It was a consulting role. And so I'd go to these, beautiful campuses for med tech companies and immediately go to the basement and grind it out in a room with no windows for hours on end. So left my developer role and went to Google, where I jumped into product and partnerships roles. We can go in a little bit deeper, but the high level is worked in the Google Enterprise business, which was first initially working on the Google Maps API, which at the time, circa 2009, was like a very new and emergent product, bringing geospatial to the web and also geospatial to mobile, which unlocked a bunch of really cool use cases. I did that in Mountain View for a bit and then got a chance to work overseas. So I lived in Sydney and Singapore for 3 years. Kind of like the whole world was my territory. So I was, in my mid-20s and was flying around the world literally about two times a quarter because there was just different things to do in different regions. I had a good run there. And kind of by the end of that, the whole world was using the Maps API. It was like critical to most of the cool emergent apps that came out during that era. After that, I was looking for something new and to move back to the States. Found a role at Google X. Google X in 2013, I think, when I joined, was like the bright, shiny object at Google. Self-driving cars, Google Glass, internet space balloons, some other stuff that, didn't make it to the public domain. And so went there into a mix of a biz dev and a product role, working on Google Glass, which was a complete dumpster fire in hindsight, but it really had a moment there where it looked like it had a shot. I could circle back on that and kind of like, what a funny moment in tech that was. But after that, I had fortunately gotten to business school. So I went to Stanford, and so left that dumpster fire behind, and at business school. Yeah, I wanted to study the things I hadn't studied in my undergrad. I studied chemistry and then ended up being a developer. So I didn't know jack about business. I learned it all on the fly. So got an MBA, studied entrepreneurial finance with the goal of working in venture, business school. Any MBAs on this call?
I don't think so.
No, good. The MBA programs, I think, universally do not take that much brain power or time. And so I had a lot of free time at the program. So I took a bunch of classes across the street at the CS department. I kind of like flipped a coin and it was like crypto AI, landed on crypto, but also found the classes being offered a bit more interesting at the time. And so went deep there, took like CS251 and some other courses taught by the likes of Dan Bonet and others, which is kind of like a legendary cryptography department. The year was 2015, 2016. So it was an awesome time to be like diving in. Bitcoin had been out for a while and had been interesting, but it wasn't a lot to build there. But in that era, Ethereum was on the way out and Solidity was being released, and there was like cool coursework to do in early Solidity programming and kind of this like whole world of possibility. So worked on that at school and then spent my free time either working with VCs or crypto startups getting into the space. I spent most of my time with a startup called Blockstream, actually, which was like a wonderful place and great people there. It turned out to be kind of like not quite aligned with where the industry was going or with where I wanted to build. So I didn't stay there full time. Blockstream is a lot of the Bitcoin core developers have set up shop, and they're trying to build like exclusively Bitcoin supportive technologies versus building in the broader design space that sort of like a Turing complete programming language like Solidity offered. So after that, did not go into crypto full time. Went to Capital One Ventures. Had some student debt to pay off, and the year was, early 2017. There just wasn't quite the ecosystem there is today. So did enterprise and fintech investing at Capital One Ventures, which was a pretty new practice at the time. Had a good run there. Did cybersecurity deals, fintech deals, good old enterprise like data and infrastructure deals, and really liked it. But I had stayed close personally to crypto, doing angel investing or just flipping tokens or, whatever, getting involved in DeFi summer at the end. And kind of at the end of that journey, felt like I had the track record and experience as a venture investor to go do something a little bit more interesting. I also knew some of the folks at Coinbase Ventures. And so took a role at Coinbase as the team lead, joining at about the same time as Catherine Wu. And it was kind of when they initially staffed up the ventures team. It had previously been like a side of desk project for a bunch of people at Coinbase. So grew the team through the bull market and into the bear market, did like a massive amount of deals, set up, operations basically from like zero to one. Wrote it down as well, and saw the, ambition and personal fit there change. So parted ways with Coinbase in early 2023. And a few months later, joined up with a good friend of mine from business school who started the Stanford Blockchain Accelerator, as well as a fund that's kind of parallel to the accelerator called the Blockchain Builders Fund, and have been working full time on building up the Stanford entrepreneurial ecosystem, and then also investing in teams in or adjacent to that ecosystem. And so that leads me here.
Amazing. That is a great journey. I kind of want to go back in time a little bit. You mentioned some cool stuff there. But you also mentioned the dumpster fire. I'm really curious about that.
Yeah.
Back us up and tell us about the Google X adventure. Why was that a dumpster fire?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if you were paying much attention to Google Glass, but it was just a divisive product. And I think it's interesting to think of like why it was so divisive. And it kind of hit this like perfect moment. I think tech was actually perceived quite positively by just about everybody, almost right up until the moment Google Glass came out. And then I forget the exact year, but Edward Snowden, kind of like leaked his files that told the world, hey, you know what? These tech companies are helping the government spy on you. And, they're being told they can't tell you about it. So, every piece of tech you hold is actually a piece of spy equipment that's, in some ways probably violating your rights as an American or as a global citizen. And I think that paired with, at least locally in San Francisco, some like economic issues, like gentrification had become a major problem. Google buses were being protested, chased down, had rocks thrown at them, like all sorts of like kind of dark stuff. And it was all happening at this moment. And just the tech narrative shifted really quickly. I think the other thing that happened almost at the exact same time was, or maybe a little bit after, but not long after, was Cambridge Analytica, right? So once again, a bunch of Facebook data was being used maliciously by all sorts of parties, but especially political ne'er-do-wells to influence elections. And suddenly, people realized what a privacy issue tech in general, but especially like big tech, Facebook and Google represented. And we were out there trying to convince people to wear computers in the face.
Right.
And so it just land
well. Got a hard sell.
Yeah. It became people were like, oh, the new iPhone. And then, within a year, they're like, face spy computers. So yeah, it didn't hit the moment very well. But then the product was also, I think, like a prototype that got overbuilt. Did any of you ever use the Google Glass device?
So I worked with a glass hole.
Okay. How was that?
So we were constantly telling him, like, would you please turn that thing off? You know, and so there were no rules, there was no etiquette around it. But just real quick, so was that during the days of Tom Chi?
You know, I knew of Tom Chi, but I didn't know him personally. We had our own UX team, and I think he was much more, like, by the time I joined Google Glass, it was like almost a standalone business. And so we had a lot of UX people, and Tom Chi was definitely like a ping pong ball across early stage projects. Did you know him?
No, but I did some, I come from a UX background, and so I did some facilitation that adopted one of his sort of prototyping frameworks for getting like rapid feedback when you're testing and, you know, kind of getting people to simulate, basically adapt a user persona. So I just remembered that from a snippet in my history, but okay, cool. So a little bit of a dumpster fire.
The product, right? It was like a passion project of Sergey Brin, and it got a lot of funding, and probably too much of that went to marketing versus maybe UX research early on. And so it had a big splash. It was it had a lot of designers. It looked beautiful, but it and this is still a problem today, even with the Vision Pro. Like, it's hard to put a big enough battery in a head-worn device to manage all the screens. It's hard to manage weight. It's hard to manage heat. And so there's just like some, you know, pure physics issues that really kept it from working well. So, you know, we did the best we could, but eventually they had to can the product. So yeah, it was a mess.
Maybe total sidebar. Did you guys, sorry, Ash, I was just going to say, did you guys see the Simpsons preview? They predicted Vision Pro. No. Yet again, they predicted the future. I don't know. Sorry, Ash, go for it.
No, I was just going to say, I think that the marketing budget, even though it was probably wild, right, would have been much more better allocated if you just signed a partnership deal with like Kanye or something like that. Just put him out there and then put him out, you know, on a music video, and that's it. Boom. All the gentrification issues go away. All the crazy UX issues goes away.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to like remember, like, we had partnerships with, you know, Ray-Bans in the work announced. We had Diane von Furstenberg, like. There was like a lot of cool stuff, and like I think like aesthetically, yeah, the device looked okay, but like it hit the issues I talked about, and then it straight up just like didn't work as a piece of tech. Like it the battery didn't last very long if you used it for any of the things you want to use it for. The thing I spent most of my time working on was like enterprise applications for Google Glass, and so we had like a whole program and a separate like product and platform arc, and so that had some promise, but even then, like, you know, in those environments, it just like wasn't like hardened enough or stable enough. But it was fun. Got to go to SpaceX's facility. Got to, you know, spend a day working behind the counter at Taco Bell. Like, gotta like, you know, use the device and help build it up in some fun like enterprise environments where like it was like, yeah, this could be cool, but definitely wasn't enterprise ready.
I remember at that time also the HoloLens was coming out. It looked like a HUD. Right, like literally, it's something that you put into a combat helmet, and then basically you'd have that heads-up display. And we would see that at times in architecture, and we'd be like, "Whoa, this is so cool!" But then we were like, "Do we even want to use this thing again?" And we're like, "Nah, I think I'm just gonna sketch it out. I think it'd be easier to just do that quickly than do that."
Our stalking horse for every use case we thought up was just like why can't I do this on a phone? Like, a phone is this like an amazing freaking device, right? Like, it has a great battery, a great horsepower, great connectivity, and like, I don't know, there's not that many things you do where you need both hands. So yeah, it's pretty hard to compete against an iPhone.
I guess at this point, should we plug our sponsor, Apple's Vision Pro? You know, like, right after this coaching segment, shout out to Timmy Cook. You know, thanks for sending us those Vision Pros. You're a real mensch, bro. Thank you.
When did I get one of those? Right.
What do you think of that for the podcast?
Right. Steve, I was going to ask you, what do you think of the new Meta Ray-Ban that's out there now? So I actually got a pair of them. So they're like, it's nice because they look just like regular glasses. So that's been nice about them. But they definitely don't try to do quite as much as the Google Glass did. But just curious your thoughts on those, or like, is it like in today's time, are we ready for that kind of thing? Was it just maybe a little early for the time, or what do you think there?
No, those seem awesome, right? Like, my favorite wearable has been my AirPods, right? Because you just they're like a very fluid, like, you know, mostly one-way experience into your digital world. And I think With LLMs, you can make it two-way, but still keep it audio. And I'm like, the norms around having like a external audio source around you are just like way different than like a invisible screen in front of you. So yeah, like super, super duper bullish on that use case, but like honestly don't even think it needs a headset, right? It could just be, right. Your AirPods could do the same thing. Like, I guess the one thing you're missing is like the vision capability, like in the, right. like the contextual, image LLM modularity is like catching up to the text quickly. So yeah, I don't know. I think that's a great platform for that. I think the challenge, and like we see it in crypto, like in a different format, is getting through like, bringing like AI on chain through like Entrustable's AI on chain through like, ZK proving. It's like, those are big, big ass models. And like, so getting them onto a pair of Ray-Bans is going to take some time, but seems very, achievable. And then having an LLM that's like low latency and on your head is going to be awesome. Super cool.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, it'll be game changer.
100% of the world will want it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of crypto, should we talk about crypto? I would love to hear a little bit more. Everybody's got their rabbit hole story. Everybody has their triggering event or something that, their aha moment. What was yours that got you started down the path of blockchain?
I was one of those dark web kids. Bitcoin solved the need, in my early 20s, and it was kind of fun. As someone who liked the Tor network and liked to be on the internet, so that was my first Bitcoin use case. I won't tell you what I bought, but that was it.
Trust me, I think that's 8 out of 10 responses.
Yeah,
very common.
But I mean, that was kind of like the a magical moment, and like, but it's funny that all the reasons that it was useful then turned out to be like wild, like mostly privacy turned out to be like wildly untrue in the long term. But at the time, it was a private way to transact without a trust. It still is a good way to transact without a trusted intermediary, but it sure isn't private or secret. But there was that was like a moment, and it certainly wasn't like a career shift. Working overseas, like I definitely like felt a lot of the pain of getting into and out of currencies, especially like not at the like tourist level, but at the like, hey, I'm living here, I need to pay rent, I like would like a credit card, like I'm managing balances in Singapore, Australia, like London, like just kind of like a huge pain. So like once again, like crypto didn't solve that problem. Still probably is like medium at solving that problem for most people, but it does like at least directionally start to solve that. And then Ethereum was it for me, right? Like when Ethereum came out, and I kind of like started getting into Solidity, I was like, holy smokes, this is super cool. way cooler than being able to put like software up on AWS. This is like this global state machine. Like that was just like a mind-blowing moment as like a bit of a CS geek. And so it didn't even have to do with the financial aspect of it. But it was like a little bit of a path to be that excited about it. It was more of like a fun, like hobbyist thing leading up to that particular moment.
And what was the timing between like that time, the discovery mode, and when you got into maybe like more full-time, like a Blockstream? How much time went by?
Yeah. So like I said, business school, lots of free time. I was, maybe like a super hobbyist, right? Like, at that point had like made some, spending cash from the appreciation of Bitcoin and Ethereum, and was like putting it back into early stage projects, was like messing around on Poloniex, which was like a fun place to make and lose money quickly. At that point it became like, maybe like the second most important professional thing I worked on. But I guess it's an interesting question though, right? Because it kind of like stayed at that level for almost 4 years while I was at Capital One. And I kept trying to make it more of a thing, but it didn't fit very well with like the traditional financial institution objectives.
Did they have a perspective at that time? Like,
I had lots of perspectives. I don't know if they're good.
No, not you, but like your Capital One colleagues, did they have a perspective on what was happening with Ethereum?
Yeah, Capital One's like a very, but I think for a bank, like innovative and like, relatively risk-seeking place. But there kind of became this moment in the 2018 bull cycle where everyone was rushing to like get leverage and put money into crypto. And so suddenly all the credit card companies particularly had to take a strong stance against crypto because people were signing up for credit cards, taking the credit card to Coinbase or some other exchange, levering up on a credit card, and then, you know, either making money or losing money, but often like leaving the bill with the credit card companies. And so they had to say like, hey, like, you know, you can't invest with the credit card. We're blocking anything with crypto in it. There kind of became like a narrative around, oh, the banks are trying to kill crypto, which I think was like a little unfair. Like they just didn't want to lend people money to speculate on crypto. But in any case, basically crypto became a bad word at Capital One after that moment. And I didn't really blame them, but it did sort of like limit my ability to do deals in the space.
No, that makes total sense. And were you during that time, you said there was kind of this 4-year period where the interest or I guess your engagement was kind of the same. Were you engaging with like projects? You mentioned investing in some stuff. Was that just as a retail investor or were you actually like in contact with teams and like starting to dig into the underbelly, if you will?
It was mostly retail and then like some like sort of like ICO angel deals, but I wouldn't say I was very deep with teams, but still staying close. But it was all pretty speculative, like, you know, some went well, some went poorly. I did sort of stay close enough to like, as DeFi summer started to happen, realize that the use pattern had changed. Seeing the like explosion of, dApps or whatever, where like a Chrome extension plus a website could enable like really new use cases. Like that was like a big leap, right? Like that was sort of like, I don't know what the word Web3 means, but that was the word Web3 to me. It's like, I have a wallet and I have a website and I can like do big financial transactions and make like, you know, big, enduring smart contract commitments, all while browsing versus like leaving the previously really like, you know, sticky, cold wallet, like Ledger Trezor experience where it was just like very awkward to sign transactions. It became very smooth and much more consumer. And it's funny, it's still, you know, it's not consumer grade even to this day, but there was like a quantum leap like sort of in 2019, 2020, I think.
Yeah, I guess on the flip side, that was also the moment when we went from the Ledger experience to getting wrecked in 30 seconds.
Yeah. Speed is good. Speed is bad.
Yeah. It feels like it went from that in that 1 year period, 365 days, we went from the asset and storage narrative to like the compute and like utility narrative. Like you can really build utility around these assets. You can like just not just put it in something and just like lose it or stupidly waste it on like dumb shit, you know, or get hacked on some like sex, you can be like, yo, I can like actually use this shit somewhere. And right. I can build the things that I want to use it on, which is pretty crazy, right? Like, yeah, it's funny that you put it that way. That's like the starting point of Web3 as a term was this literally in that year. That's kind of crazy. I never thought.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what it is for other people, but for me, it was like the MetaMask Chrome extension. Just like, oh, sweet. Like, you know, I'm not intermediated by sexes anymore. I'm like doing crazy stuff on chain. I have no, like, you know, 90% of the time I'm just like signing things like, you know, without any real understanding of what the underlying is, just because I want to see if it works. And, you know, it's getting better now, but it was a lot of fun.
You're a dangerous clicker, my friend.
I'm more cautious now. Fortunately, there was just like the stuff was inscrutable then. It was like, you know, a web page in HTML says this is what it's going to do. And then like, you know, your trusted wallet just gives you, you know, garbage, like unreadable garbage. And you're like, well, okay.
Well, who remembers trying to interact with the curve interface for the first time?
Oh, like, yeah.
I don't remember that experience. Tell me more.
Absolutely. It was absolutely true. I mean, it was designed like a 1990s, you know, Windows interface, but nobody knew what it was doing in the beginning. I'm pretty convinced of that. Like, you know, I knew people who read the white paper and thought they understood everything, but I'm like, I don't think you do. And it turns out a lot of them didn't because a lot got wrecked.
Yeah. The best way to learn about it is losing money, right? It's like, what's impermanent loss? Impermanent. How bad could it be? I'm in. Right.
Technically, it's not real unless you take your money out. So it's technically not a loss, guys. Technically, I'm still up 1,000,000x, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it is wild. It really is funny to like have this experience of like going to build in like Web 2 to like Web 3, and now like also like, you know, when you're investing in the ICOs, it kind of gives you like this different kind of threshold of like understanding the tech, understanding the teams, and then understanding the product, right? Like, it's a different kind of thing than like when you're in Glass, for example, right? Like when you're built, just you're like, hey, I have to perform this one functionality and understand like this kind of like T-shaped thing around the product, right? But like now you're like, oh shit, like I have to dissect it in terms of like, I'm allocating this capital, I'm trying to figure out whether it'll work, I'm trying to figure out tech stack will work. It's a completely different thing. I mean, that's like,
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and yeah, some of it has to do just with like a tolerance for risk and like when and how you want to learn things, right? It's also interesting at various moments over the past few years, like what constitutes what constitutes sufficient like knowledge and de-risking. There's like, you know, at the poor end of the spectrum, there's like what the UX tells you, like the HTML. There might be like getting on chain through like an explorer and kind of like looking at other people's transactions and kind of like, you know, seeing if you're coming in through the same input. That's pretty advanced. Or sort of like, you know, I think friends are honestly have been like the most trustworthy way, like, hey, I did this thing and this other thing happened. And yeah, it's now it feels like it's getting like a fair bit better. Like the wallets are giving you like a pretty good sense of what's happening. The, you know, documentation is better. Even the HTML components are like, you know, more descriptive with more disclaimers often. So yeah, it's getting a lot better. But yeah, I think early on learning was very difficult.
Absolutely agree. Yeah. I mean, I remember in the beginning, like, you know, all I wanted was some sort of transaction simulator that would let me, you know, what's going to happen if I sign this? And it just didn't exist. And then like Fire and some others came out. And so now it's feeling like that's going to be standard flow in the UX. Like, we should simulate these things. We should give the user the heads up, give them the opportunity to retract the transaction if they did something stupid, which we all do from time to time. So, but I agree, in the beginning, it was just wild, wild west. I mean, it's still wild west, but it was really raw in the beginning.
Yeah. It's sort of like pulling this thread though. It is kind of also interesting to like get to, like, if you guys played with Farcaster, I assume you have, right? Unmissable thing this week. Right. Like, the UX is so good that I suddenly don't care anymore. Like, what's going on chain. Like, I honestly, right. We invested in that project Coinbase. At some point I asked Dan about like his architecture, and it was like, you know, a good mix of on-chain, off-chain, moving on-chain. And it's like, but it's changed a lot. And I just like, I have no idea, but I'm like, I guess one thing, the stakes are low. It's like a social platform. But I do care about my works, you know? But two, it's just like the UX is so good. In the main, like, you know, Warpcaster client and in other ones, that it's like, it doesn't feel mysterious anymore. And that's like, that's a great place to be. It's a very happy, stage of development we're at.
Yeah, it's kind of wild because, like, in the Bitcoin space, like, we're seeing even like the people on the Bitcoin side, the UTXO side, and they're like, dude, like, we have Noster and all these things. And I'm like, and now they're all talking about like Warpcast. And I'm like, wait, I thought we were the altcoin retards that came in here that you guys didn't want anything to do with. And like, they're like, bro, can you get me on Warpcast? I'm like, it's permissionless. I was telling you about this like 7 months ago when I could have given you the invites. But like, they're coming in there and they are blown away by the UX and like blown away by the fact that I'm like, holy shit, like, it feels seamless. It feels amazing. Like, really, like, it's a real testament when you get a Bitcoiner to want to come on there and be like, wow, I wish we had this on UTXO.
Yeah, nice.
UX, this is empathy building. So Bitcoiners get Farcaster, ETH Maxis get Inscriptions. The world is right. So, Steve, can we dig into your time at Coinbase a little bit?
Absolutely.
So you joined in a pretty crazy time because you said you took the ride up, you took the ride down. So I'm sure that was, you know, wild times, lots of things happening around the organization, lots of deal flow. But just, you know, tell us a little bit more about that experience. What was crazy? What was cool? What was painful? And also, what did you learn in that cycle that, you know, you carry forward as you start working on your next chapter?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll circle back to like lessons learned and just like maybe give you the timeline version first, and hopefully that's fodder for conversation. So I joined I think it must have been like late summer 2021. Yeah, late summer 2021, maybe a little bit later. I'd just gotten off PAT leave from Capital One, so I kind of like gave them my notice while on leave. But I'd been there 4 years. They'd gotten what they needed out of me. I think all was good. And yeah, the place is wild. They'd IPO'd a little bit earlier that year. You know, they were growing like crazy. They were, you know, were hiring like they were going to be, you know, the next Google. And it was a remote company with like a crazy Slack culture. It was just in the like total heat of the bull market. The place was printing cash. You know, assets were just moving an insane amount every day. Yeah, it was just like a totally wild time. And like, as someone who had been more of a hobbyist and, you know, came in like one because I had like maybe enough crypto context to be dangerous, but like in particular had like a, you know, what I felt like a very like rigorous like corporate venture practice, like managerial experience to bring to bear. It was just like insanely hard to keep track of all the motion inside of Coinbase and then all the motion inside the market. Fortunately, Coinbase has had, and you know, even today, like has a really privileged position in the marketplace. They have earned their trust through multiple cycles. They have an insane alumni network, like, you know, lots of Coinbase Mafia out there today, and just like a stellar brand. And so the connectivity of that organization to the crypto ecosystem is insane. So from a venture perspective, you'd see everything. Literally everything would come to you in some shape or form, which I think is the big asterisk. And so you'd have shots at, you know, every company. Now, sort of open-ended, like when you get that shot in terms of like valuation / like stage, sort of, you know, big question mark in terms of like allocation available, big question mark in terms of like timing, like, hey, do you have any time to actually like think, or, you know, were you the last port of a call on a deal that, you know, was already probably only like, you know, 2 weeks of open market before that was like, you know, cash in bank. So it was a funny seat to be an investor. And then, yeah, just like also the staffing of the team when I joined, and even after it was staffed up, was still just like very lean and dependent kind of on the like free time and charity of, you know, technical people, product people. The corp dev team gave a lot of support. But it was also like, there's only so many people who had it as a full-time job. So it was definitely like a very wild spot to be doing venture. Yeah, what else to add there? So yeah, that's the bull market.
Can I ask a quick question about the... Mm-hmm. So, you know, having listened to Armstrong a number of times, I think people, you know, are familiar with his vibe, with his ethos, pretty principled guy, it seems. I'm curious if that bled over into the VC side in terms of, you know, an investment thesis, or during a bull market, it's always crazy, right? And so there's a lot of opportunistic investing happening. But, you know, did you guys have specific things that you were on the lookout for, or, you know, building in a way that sort of went with the narrative that you were, that's part of the vision?
Yeah. So I think there's some good pieces in kind of like the, you know, foundation canon for ventures that Emily Choi built out. And it was, we very much wanted to seed the ecosystem. And I think we wanted to be like opinionated on what was likely to be successful. And we wanted to be opinionated on what was good. But we didn't want to be so opinionated that we like were like trying to steer the industry in a direction. So
right.
We had broad remit, and we actually tried to be very broadly exposed to a lot of things that were going on. Like, so we invested across, like, you know, for instance, many L1s. We invested in the Bitcoin ecosystem. You know, we invested in basically, you know, anything that we could justify financially, and we thought that Coinbase could be supportive of. We obviously tried to avoid like the scams, which, you know, is pretty hard in crypto. And when you're this like, you know, big bright light, like, you know, moths come to you quickly. So there's a lot of scammers knocking on our doors. We tried our best, and I think we did a good job of avoiding them. And, you know, there's the, if you're a crypto investor, those patterns become kind of easy to spot, you know, sort of people who aren't talking about tech or users or use cases, and instead you know, half their pitch deck is their, you know, plan to kind of like squeeze valuation up, you know, after you, if that's the main selling point, that's probably not a good project. What else? Yeah, I don't know. It's like most things in crypto, if they're likely to be successful and bring on users, they're going to like return to the network effect of crypto. And I think it's really good for Coinbase to not be too opinionated about like Solana versus Ethereum or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, especially because we're still, it's cliche at this point, but we're still early, you know, and I think the space still needs a lot of room to breathe. So, okay, well, so transitioning into the bear then, you know, bears suck for everybody. So I can imagine like changes the sentiment, changes the team. You leave Coinbase, but now you're on to something new. So tell us about your work at Blockchain Founders Fund, right?
Blockchain Builders Fund. Yeah, it's a mouthful. BBF for short.
BBF, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, let's see. This is an interesting one. So while I was still at Coinbase, a good friend of mine started the Stanford Blockchain Accelerator. And kind of like the genesis was, and it was actually a similar timeline to my time at Coinbase. There was a lot of interest in crypto or Web3 or whatever, blockchain entrepreneurship. But there was like very little in the way of resources. And so I wasn't there for this, but my partner, Kun Peng, and my partner, Gil Rosen, were. And so they revived the Stanford Blockchain Club along with some other students and started bringing in programming and then also started an accelerator. Stanford is like an amazing school for entrepreneurship. There's like lots of practitioner lecturers, you know, VCs, entrepreneurs, et cetera. There's many programs to support startups. There's the design school that David Kelly started. There's many programs. There's Cardinal Ventures. There's StartX. There's, I don't know, dozens of these things, right? But just like none of them serviced crypto very well. And none of them serviced blockchain, whatever. Whatever acronym you want to use. And so there's a nice spot for an accelerator. And the accelerator is very simple. Some very light programming and from the like core teaching crew, and then lots of guest speakers from industry to talk about, you know, the most basic topics. You know, most of the accelerator teams were, you know, somewhat crypto savvy, but they didn't know the differences between fundraising in the space. They maybe didn't know what the partnership landscape looked like. They certainly didn't know enough, and still no one does, about like sort of like how to manage like the regulatory risk and tokenomics in a way that's like fair, sustainable, you know, leads to true decentralization, but also, you know, provides enough capital to actually grow something. And so there was like these big open, you know, kind of like what is the state of the art questions that evolve every 6 months that bringing in outside speakers was super helpful for. And, you know, it was partially the market, right? There was a lot of crypto startups coming out of Stanford, but I also think that the accelerator, you know, significantly increased the success rate of those teams in launching products and raising money and ultimately being like enduring businesses. So yeah, that was the accelerator's backstory. Partway through that journey, having gone to Stanford and knowing the founders of the accelerator, I came on as a mentor while at Coinbase and worked with a lot of those teams and was kind of just like blown away by like the talent. But like the crazy thing about Stanford, it's like, yes, very smart, but just like really ambitious people, both in the like student base and also in the alumni base. And by the way, the accelerators for students and alumni. And so anyway, I was impressed. And then, you know, a little bit further along that journey, Gil was like, okay, you know, I want to find a way to do this full time. You know, I'm going to also start a fund. The accelerator is free, non-dilutive. It is a sort of like alumni and student property. But, you know, a small fund will opportunistically invest in the Stanford ecosystem. So not just the accelerator, but, you know, ideally in the network of the Stanford ecosystem. And so he started the fund, and it was good timing, bear market at Coinbase. I'd had my fund there, but like kind of like the mission and mandate was changing. So parted ways with Coinbase. And after having my second kid, joined up there. It was like, as I mentioned, the seat that Coinbase had was incredible. You saw everything, but like kind of like the stress level and sort of like the depth of both like diligence and then like relationship with the businesses were just like so thin, right? Like Coinbase did, you know, well over 100 deals a year, well over. And wow. So, you know, you didn't learn a lot about these teams. You kind of like used the heuristics you had, like, you know, referrals from network, sort of like lead invest, all these other things. And then after you did the deal, it was just like another logo on the, 400 team logo board, right? And so this is the opposite, at least for me, and I'm loving it, right? Where it's like, 12, at least for the accelerator, it's 12 teams, twice a year, go really, really deep with those 12 teams, see them make a lot of progress, build like lasting relationships that endure well past the accelerator, and like, really get involved with these teams. We often like get referred to as, members of the team. I'm doing that process, and it's fun. And it's also like a great seat from a different perspective. Instead of like using the, crypto ecosystem for like signal, we really get to like partner closely with like thought leaders to support teams and like build out thought leadership. So, get to learn a lot, get to go deep on topics. We've also, by the way, started a event series called BAS, which is the Blockchain Application Summit Stanford. It's definitely like a forced acronym, but it's a good one. People like fish. And so it started out as like a small takeover of SBC, which is the Science of Blockchain Conference, like a week in Palo Alto focused on blockchain research. And it's more focused on like, if the SBC is like research that's like 5 to 10 years away in terms of implementation, because it's like cryptography breakthroughs, we're more like 1 to 2 years away in terms of implementation, in terms of like product releases or like, very specific research. And so we've turned that into a bit of a traveling circus. So it happens once a year on campus, and then we're doing a big like full day event at ETH Denver, with thousands of registrations and like a killer speaker list. And we'll probably do something in the fall as well, maybe in Thailand. So anyway, but it follows the same like mission and mandate, right? Like sort of like get together thought leaders, help them share what the state of the art is for builders in the space, and move the space forward. And in particular, and it's not exclusively for the Stanford ecosystem, but it really leans on the Stanford ecosystem to be the core of like, ambitious, ethical building in the space. And I don't know, there's probably 1,000 ways to get to that same endpoint, but this has been a good one.
That's great. Yeah, no, it's really cool to see how you're connecting the dots in the ecosystem that way. And I think, your purview and your time at Coinbase probably gives you a perspective that a lot of people in a similar situation don't have, in terms of having seen like crazy, activity during a bull market, teams that are focused on, really just taking advantage of that moment in time, and then bringing that all the way back down to how do we go back to first principles? How do we think about, using this as a sustainable way to build the future of crypto? I'm curious, what are you most excited about in terms of the ideas or the teams or the innovation that you're seeing? Like, what do you wake up in the morning jazzed about?
It's different every week, which is part of the fun. We've just started off a new cohort. So let me talk about some of the things that came out of the last. I'm very over-indexed in the teams I've worked with, because like you work so closely with teams, you get really excited about what they're doing. So if I go back to the last cohort, there's a bunch of great things happening there. Like one of the ones we're really excited about is a subsector of DPIN, which is solving this like GPU shortage problem, right? And so we had a team called, and sorry, maybe I should just talk about topics and not shell teams, but it grounds the conversation. So Exhibits, they really smart, sort of like research background founders who like really understand GPU acceleration and decentralized systems. And so they're launching a GPU network, and there's a couple of players going after this problem, and that's awesome, right? Because I think it's a big problem that probably needs a few shots on goal. But we now have like these new computational needs around AI and specifically LLMs, and we have a like stark shortage of GPU cycles or workloads. And so this team is working on ways to like establish a decentralized network, so more GPUs can be online more of the time and not kind of have like workload gaps. And then also ways to accelerate those GPUs when they are, not always co-located, right? And they're not always the highest end. And also creating like sort of like a like tiering or discrimination around like, hey, what use cases, need H100s, and what use cases can be farmed out to like consumer grade devices, either in small data centers or, even in your gaming rig around the corner. So that one's really good. I think that's just like a huge space and a huge need. And it also is just like, some wonderfully talented and technical founders like who are going after this problem. And I think it's a really cool unlock from, you know, there's like some talent that kind of like didn't have entrepreneurial opportunities, and like crypto really, in some ways, like unlocks those entrepreneurs. It's funny, I think of like this, you know, decentralized, like DPIN or like decentralized compute startups is, you know, previously being people stuck working on like, you know, for data center businesses, and now they have a shot at doing something that's much larger scale. I know that when doing gaming deals at Coinbase, and this is a while back and kind of like we're in much more wait and see on Web3 gaming, it was still just awesome to see how a moment like a revelation in crypto suddenly made it so like amazing game designers and developers could like leave their sort of like job at one of like, you know, four big game studios and go start their own business because, you know, crypto, like one, give them the financing and, you know, right or wrong, but two, also like opened up new distribution pathways and new growth pathways such that you could build a different type of business, and you didn't have to be beholden to the organization of distribution, and people who wanted to be entrepreneurs could go be entrepreneurs. So sorry, that was a bit of a tangent. Something else, just like infrastructure, like Stanford has these like really like storied and long running like cryptography departments, which I think in the past like also didn't have as much of a commercial application as they do today. Now they are super sought after in crypto. And so we have a number of teams who have like, you know, deep, you know, sort of like, you know, beyond the cutting edge ZK expertise and are building up ZK ML or ZK co-processing technologies that will like unlock new on-chain use cases by allowing provable compute to come on chain. So that's like a really fun category, and love our founders in that space. But then there's also like, you know, maybe even like CS students at Stanford or master students at Stanford who might not even be like, you know, sort of like that cutting edge research students are still can be very smart in ZK and can build more application based use cases. So we have like a privacy protocol that is super exciting. Looking forward, starting to see some like more social applications come out. Like, have you guys played with Unibot much?
I haven't.
Unibot, so it's a Telegram bot. And so that doesn't mean it's a bot that's like an agent on Telegram, like, you know, hacking or spamming people. It's a bot that you bring into your chats and it adds a bunch of features, right? And it gives you a wallet. It gives you the ability to trade in line in Telegram. It's super popular. It's like a very cool new social UX for Web3. So Unibot was a very exciting revelation in terms of like how you could bring Web3 into a messenger. And so anyway, we're seeing some teams working on sort of like new bot experiences within Telegram that are highly integrated into Web3. And then that to me is just like part and parcel to what's happening on Farcaster, actually, right? Which is like, we're sort of like, you know, how does Web3 get, you know, move on to whatever the next instantiation is? Like, how does it get more integrated into how we live our digital lives? And it feels like deep integration into messaging, deep integration into like a social network is like a very cool and interesting next step.
What's really interesting about your background, and, you know, I think a lot of people have this experience where we don't really see how we're connecting the dots going forward, but looking backwards, we can see these connections or how they kind of played into each other. And just hearing your story and your background about, you know, going from Google X, where you're in this innovation-rich environment, and then you spend some time at Capital One thinking more about like corp dev and you know, the corporate side of things. And then you go to Coinbase and you're thinking more about the investment and the ecosystem. And now you're moving into a position where I think all of that stuff's coming together. And I'm curious what your perspective is about how, I guess, the environment has changed for founders during your time in crypto. You know, do you see, does it take a different perspective or a different mentality today to be successful than it did, say, even 5 or 6 years ago? Or what are the big changes that you see?
I mean, 5 or 6 years ago for crypto founders is an interesting moment in time. Probably not the one I'd choose. I'd choose like, 5 or 6 years ago, it was very hard to be a founder in crypto. You had to be deeply technical and you had almost no tools. And so you had to build buildings. You had to like build your full stack. Super duper hard, super capital intensive. Not a lot of people who could do it.
You had to be a missionary too. you really had to believe.
Total believer. Right. So that was I think a very tough moment for like, at least like venture backed entrepreneurship. Although anyway, so that was an interesting era. then you kind of like just didn't have nearly as many people with the skill set to do the work. I think 2 years ago was, in hindsight, an awful time to be a crypto entrepreneur. Like, all the wrong incentives, like very, like, you know, misleading signal on product market fit, TAM, et cetera. And so, like, I genuinely feel for a lot of entrepreneurs who jumped into the space at that time, because they were just being told, given signal to do things that they probably should have been more thoughtful about. And then now they're stuck.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And I'm sure, you know, many of those founders will find the way, but they have high watermarks in terms of valuation. They started down the product path and probably put a fair bit of money and effort into, you know, something that the use case pattern, you know, depended on, you know, Ponzinomics at the moment. I feel for those founders. And like, I think, like, most importantly today, like, you know, the market's turning, right? I'm an investor, so I have like LPs and I have like a lot of the pressures that founders have, right? But you meet young founders who suddenly start to get like the interest of the market. But that interest, like, those conversations are very conditional. It's like, you're going to have a token, you're going to launch it soon, you're going to da 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 da. And you can kind of like see the same patterns of investors and or users who are just like, you know, very much in it for token go up, starting to steer entrepreneurs. And so it's, I feel very lucky this time around to be working with teams much more closely and to like have that visibility and, you know, try to share the war stories and caution teams like, nope, build value, like, make sure you build for real users, like, ignore fake users, you know, find like true ways to distinguish between the two. You know, keep in mind that your lockup's 4 years, so who cares if your token goes up this year, or 6 years, or whatever the pattern is. Like, by the way, so is mine. So like, let's optimize for, you know, 10 years instead of 2 years. It's nice to have like had those lessons and have enough time with teams to like really convey them. I'm also hopeful that, like, you know, I'm not the only one who learned them. That people have a longer memory than I think they do. But crypto is very special that way. If you go back to like the similar lessons in enterprise, with just like multiple expansion over, you know, kind of like the 20 teens to 2020, but not nearly as bad. So anyway, I hope crypto entrepreneurs like learn from the past, and make sure that they're building for real metrics.
That's always my hope too. My hope is that those lessons come back and come into the community, come into the culture. The challenge is that every cycle brings a new wave of users who haven't been through that yet. And so it's hard to fight that initial enthusiasm, but yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's funny. This cycle like has brought the professionalization of speculation, like any speculative opportunity. It used to bring a lot of like, at least like speculative users, but now it just brings like, you know, airdrop farms. Right. And so now it's like, I don't like have a coherent thought about this, but I'm hoping that actually that makes entrepreneurs even like care way less about the sort of like the bad usage they can drive, you know, through just like, you know, poorly thought out airdrops or ill-conceived point systems, and like really drill in on like what it is they need to build for. Maybe it'll make it harder, but I'm hoping it makes it easier.
And one of my questions that rolls around in my head sometimes is, you know, I wonder if Web 2 or more traditional industries, traditional marketing and businesses are going to start to kind of lean into some of the Web 3 dynamics, you know, things like FOMO, things like, you know, wanting to be unique, wanting to have traits, community, like these are narratives that are starting to come forward in more mainstream applications. And I just wonder if, like, as much as we want to kind of wash that out of the industry, if some of that is actually going to be what pulls us into the future.
Interesting. Are you specifically referring to kind of like some of the like growth and marketing tactics of
growth marketing, even the way that marketers are thinking about things like loyalty? That's the space that I'm in. And so, you know, loyalty marketers starting to look at Web3 and looking at components like, you know, collectability and FOMO as desirable aspects to bring into a traditional business or revenue model.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to see that, right? It's like, you know, who've done a good job of that, like Starbucks, Reddit, like there's a couple examples of, like, you know, cool collectibles coming out of, you know, Web2 businesses using like Web3 infrastructure, or like it doesn't even have to be on Web3 infrastructure, frankly, as long as it's like a sort of like durable digital good. Although I think everyone should build on Web3 infrastructure. I hope to see more of it. I'm very curious, right? It's all felt like those are like the shining examples, but there's kind of like a thin pool after that, at least in my mind. Like maybe I'm spending too much time on infrastructure, but I wonder when it'll happen. It's always to me been a bit of a chicken and egg. Like, do we all need wallets? Do we all need sort of like some understanding of like crypto and ownership and signatures? Or like, is that the egg or chicken? Or do we need like just really good account abstraction technology to be like cheap and pervasive? Will that enable like broader adoption, at least in those like marketing and growth, like brand-led use cases? I'm not sure, but we're certainly, as we do in crypto, we're building all that stuff. So hopefully someone comes and uses it.
Awesome. Well, Steve, we want to be respectful of your time here. It's been awesome to jam out with you for an hour or so. You talked earlier about takeaways. You said you'd come back to those. And so just wanted to maybe, you know, cap this off with some of your lessons learned. What one or two pieces of advice would you share with the current crop of people that are building in the space right now, you know, given your time in crypto?
Yes. Probably the piece of advice I give every day to teams today is like, you know, build as fast as you can, but not faster. The market cycles are going to happen. But your product, will you can't like accelerate product market fit. You need to find it and grow naturally. So don't feel like you have some like arbitrary like market timing timeline around what is like one of the hardest tasks in the world, which is building a product that someone wants. To the extent you can, like don't check your wallet, Coinbase account, whatever it is every day, and like use that as a barometer for what or how fast you should be building. The other thing is like for people coming into crypto and Web3, it's like a very long game and you need to build relationships up over time. I think in particular because like things change so fast, like you know, maybe the tech will change, but the people won't. So you can like really rely on long lasting relationships to like help you navigate either like the emerging partnership landscape, emerging tech landscape, emerging talent landscape. It's definitely worth it to invest in the people around you. Just like long-termism, like you're not going to miss it. Yeah. You're still super early, like invest in the things that matter.
Well, I think those are sage words from a man who has obviously spent many, many hours in Telegram channels.
pretty bad.
Yeah, feel you on that one. Thanks for hanging out again. Where can people go to learn more about what you're up to, follow you, connect with you?
Yes, awesome. So I have a poor Twitter presence, but it's SR Willinger, like my name, and maybe if there's like a text that goes with this podcast, I can share it there. I'm at Steve on Farcaster, which I'm pretty proud of. Good nice. Handle. And then I'll give you like my accelerator website. For folks going to Denver, we are hosting an event called Bass Denver. It's on Friday, March 1st. It is all day. I will share the link to that event, but I would invite everyone to come. And if you just put the name of the podcast into there's like a referral text box. If you put the name of the podcast in there, I will try to accelerate your admission. We are oversubscribed, but we haven't decided who gets in. So any sort of like thing to bump your profile will help us choose you.
That's awesome. Very nice. And listeners, we will include all of that in the show notes. So definitely check that out and get those links.
Great. Thanks, awesome. Guys. Really enjoyed it.